Russia says its military hit all the targets in an overnight missile strike on Ukraine after Kiev announced it downed nearly 20 Russian missiles. The United Arab Emirates invites Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to attend a UN climate summit in Dubai later this year. And new official data shows unemployment rate in the UK rose in the first 3 months of this year amid a deepening cost of living crisis. Hello and welcome from Tehran, YouTube's World News. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Russia says it has hit all the intended targets during its latest overnight strikes on Ukraine.
Last night, the armed forces of the Russian Federation launched a concentrated strike with high-precision long-range air and sea-based weapons at the locations of Ukraine's army units, as well as the storage sites for ammunition, weapons, and military equipment supplied by Western countries. The target of the strike has been achieved. All assigned targets have been hit.
The spokesman said Russian Kinzhal hypersonic missiles also destroyed a U.S. Patriot defense system stationed in Ukraine. Earlier, Ukraine said it had shot down 18 Russian missiles, claiming that six of them were hypersonic ones. A Ukrainian military official called Moscow's latest assault exceptional in terms of density. Well, the airstrikes hit the capital, Kiev, and surrounding cities. Meanwhile, six African leaders are to travel to Russia and Ukraine to help find a solution to the war. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the trip is to be arranged as soon as possible. Both presidents of the warring sides have agreed to receive the mission. Ramaphosa held separate telephone calls with Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky over the weekend, presenting an initiative drawn up by Zambia, Senegal, the Republic of Congo, Uganda, Egypt, and South Africa. Meanwhile, a high-level Chinese envoy led by Li Wu is set to begin a trip to Europe that will also take him to Ukraine and Russia. Li served as an ambassador to Russia for 10 years and is assigned with the job of promoting Beijing-led peace negotiations to broker a ceasefire and an end to the fighting in Ukraine. Li will be visiting Ukraine on May the 16th and 17th. Well, we've discussed the recent developments in the Russia-Ukraine war in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Greg Simmons is a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden, who joins us. We also have Glenn Deason, who's a professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, joining us from Oslo. Welcome to you both. What do you make, Glenn Deason, of the fact that the Ukrainian president has to travel to the UK, for example, and make requests for military equipment, which I guess the UK has promised that's going to provide it these long-range missiles, not yet, but in the coming months. But the fact that he has to travel to get the military equipment to Europe, what's your take on it?
Well, I think this is one of Zelensky's strengths. His former profession, obviously being an actor. He's also good at appealing to Western audiences. He's been quite active. The amount of time he spent speaking to various parliaments and Eurovision, like whoever he's speaking to, he's been quite good at reaching out. And this puts pressure on governments also because we've been ramping up this anti-Russian rhetoric for so long that if it comes there's greater pressure, of course, to give weapons. And as Ukraine is preparing this offensive of theirs, they obviously need much more weapon because Russia has profoundly degraded their military capabilities. That is, knocked out a lot of their and most of their air defenses. We've seen over the past two weeks especially, how the weapons depots across Ukraine have been struck. And so I think that they need much more weapons, but also heavier weapons, because in the West there's been some concern about escalating. However, we see now this slow incrementalism where the British, and then probably followed by the French, are prepared to escalate further, because the closer Ukraine comes to a defeat, the more Zelensky will go to these Western capitals and he will receive heavier and heavier weapons with longer range. And this is, you know, taking us one step at a time closer, effectively, to a nuclear exchange.
You know, when we talk about the escalation, it seems like there's no letting up when it comes to either the U.S. or the European support, Greg Simmons, for Ukraine militarily and in terms of, I'm sure, finances also. But I'm wondering what they think when report just came out that Russian oil exports has reached its highest level since the special military operation, generating the most revenue that it did. Well, this, I mean, I'm guessing this shows that Russia can continue this war. What are they thinking, you think?
Well, the Europeans do not have any original thoughts of their own. They do whatever Washington tells them. And I mean, this is clear from the very beginning with all these different sanctions and what not to do. I mean, not only are we talking about an increase of these Russian oil exports, but also, I mean, this destruction of their own economies. I mean, you had this stupid comment from Borrell, the originator of this garden concept, who recently said that to block those Indian exports of Russian oil to Europe. So, I mean, they are prepared to destroy themselves for the US because this is what it's about. This is not about Europe. It's not about Ukraine. It's about US global hegemony.
All right. And finally, the way that this war is progressing, it doesn't seem like either side is going to let up. There's a supposed summer, I guess, counteroffensive, if you want to call it, coming from Ukraine. Glenn Deason, what are we looking at where there's a breaking point that may be achieved here, where one or the other side is going to say, okay, enough is enough, and let's get down to talks?
Well, that's the big question, because so far this has become an all-or-nothing war. I mean, for Russia, they consider this to be an existential threat, much like if for the Americans, if the Russians would establish themselves in Mexico, it simply threatens their existence. So they will never be able to step down from this unless they get some deals with NATO. That would be the main thing to negotiate, to have some agreement on ending the NATO expansionism. But beyond that, I think the Ukrainians have also locked themselves, at least Zelensky rhetorically, into no compromise at all. So it's very absolute positions, and the West also doesn't seem willing to let Ukraine fail, hence breaking every red line and being prepared to send heavier and heavier weapons. So I think it will. Well, what we will see in the next few months now is the Ukrainian army suffering immensely and moving towards collapse, at which point in time the West will have a dilemma. Do we send in our own troops? Do we send a much more heavy weapon in which we're in a direct war with the Russians? Or do we let Ukraine fail? And I think the problem is once we actually sit down and negotiate, the question is what kind of agreement can we actually reach? Because there's no trust on either side. I mean, so I think it's going to go for effectively a military victory at some point.
Okay, thank you for that. Glenn Deason, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway. And thank you, Greg Simmons, researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Now, the United Arab Emirates has invited Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to attend a UN climate summit in Dubai later this year. The invitation to the summit comes as the Arab world is gradually warming to Damascus after a long period of cold relations since the 2011 breakout of foreign-led militancy in Syria. The UAE reestablished ties with Syria in 2018. In March of last year, Assad visited the UAE on his first official trip to an Arab country since 2011. He also visited the UAE this year. In March, Saudi Arabia also normalized its ties with Syria. The Arab League has also welcomed back Damascus, whose membership was suspended for more than a decade. Assad has also received an invitation to an Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia scheduled for Friday. Moving on to other news this hour, Israeli forces have carried out fresh violent raids on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces stormed the camp in the city of Jenin and detained a Palestinian claiming he had collaborated with resistance fighters. At least three Palestinians were also injured in the attack. The refugee camp has often been targeted under different pretexts. It is home to more than 22,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their ancestral homes by the regime in 1948. Israel has stepped up its attacks on occupied Palestinian towns and cities, killing nearly 120 Palestinians so far this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, earlier joined us to give us more details on the latest Israeli raid on Jenin.
The clashes unfortunately led to the injury of three Palestinians. One of them is in serious condition, according to Palestinian paramedics, where the Israeli forces used live fire, of course, against the Palestinians there. The Israelis arrested one Palestinian. They claim that he's responsible for a series of shootings that took place in the last few weeks against Israeli forces and settlers in areas around Jenin. Also, this morning, Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Aqbat Jaber near Ariha in the Jordan Valley. Clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli forces. At least seven Palestinians were detained by the Israeli soldiers from Aqbat Jaber. Palestinian prisoners groups issued a statement saying that at least 25 Palestinians had been arrested by the Israeli forces only this morning in several areas, including Jenin, Aqbat Jaber refugee camp in Ramallah, Nablus, and Bethlehem as well.
Now to the UK, where new data shows an increase in the number of unemployed seeking jobs as Britons are grappling with a painful cost of living crisis. According to the Office for National Statistics, the unemployment rate rose to 3.9% in the first 3 months of 2023. The British economy also witnessed a drop in total payrolled employees between March and April. Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has expressed worries about difficulty in recruiting employees as well as soaring prices for many people that are dealing with the crisis. The UK economic woes go beyond the problems revolving around the labor force. Now, the value of the British pound against the US dollar has fallen by about 50 basis points and nearly 1.5%. For months, the UK has been reeling from a double-digit inflation and a series of walkouts over pay and working conditions. Saeed Poor has joined us a while ago with his take on the high unemployment rate in the UK.
A couple of reasons why this is happening. One is different age groups not seeking jobs. For example, the 16 to 25-year-old age group are practically students who are not seeking jobs, or also early retirement, people who have retired and when asked if they would want to go back to work, their answer was no. And a number of other reasons, of course, but all of that could be collectively blamed on inflation, as you said earlier. And what has caused inflation here? The cost of living crisis, of course, you know, just a few months ago, the reason was blamed on the wholesale energy price hikes internationally ensuing the Russo-Ukraine war, but then energy prices have stabilized. The inflation in the UK is still in the double digits, above 10%. We've seen, of course, it go above 11% at one point. And then the increase in savings, people not spending, then preferring to save their money because of the increase in the interest rates by the Bank of England. There is also other reasons, like the shift from spending on goods and products to experiences.
Well, the EU's spring 2023 economic forecast predicts subdued growth across the 27-country bloc, but suggests that there are mounting risks to financial well-being. The ongoing conflict in Ukraine has again been singled out as a particular concern. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war. A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans has been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And now to Sudan, where fighting continues between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, despite the ongoing ceasefire talks between the two sides and Saudi Arabia. Heavy bombardments have been heard in the south of the capital, Khartoum, and neighboring cities of Omdurman and Bahri. Recently, deadly violence also broke out in the western region of Darfur. Residents and human rights groups are warning that the situation could turn catastrophic. The unrest gripped the African nation in mid-April over the paramilitary group's proposed integration into the army. 1 month into the conflict, nearly 700 people have been killed and thousands wounded. Thousands of other Sudanese have fled the country, while tens of thousands have been displaced internally. Now, the warring factions are currently holding talks in Saudi Arabia to secure a lengthy ceasefire that would allow humanitarian access to conflict areas. Now to the United States, where a shooting in the southwestern state of New Mexico has left four people dead, including the suspect. The incident took place in the town of Farmington. Two officers were also wounded in the exchange of gunfire with the suspect. Police say there were multiple civilian victims, at least three of whom have died. The shooter was believed to have acted alone. So far, there is no details on the reason behind the attack. The frequency of shooting incidents in the U.S. has increased significantly in recent years. This as politicians remain deadlocked on tighter gun control laws. And with that brings us to the end of this Worldless edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. For a couple of episodes, we have dwelt upon the views of the French thinker Michel Foucault on Imam Khomeini. Today, we will continue the discussion. Michel Foucault believed that not only religion is not the opium of masses, but also it is the spirit of the spiritless world. In view of this, he maintained that religion is the engine which unites various classes in society and brings their forces together towards a common goal. Today we are going to explain Foucault's opinion on the concept of power in the Islamic Revolution. Stay with us, please. French thinker Michel Foucault is of the opinion that power is not limited to a specific group, class, or person. He believes that power has a network structure, which is spread in the whole society like the nervous system. Power is a kind of software and is not necessarily wielded through violent means. Thus, a speech, a book, a tape, a piece of voice or video in the modern form of the medium can be a source of power. The French thinker says that power has been spread in every individual, and if they get united, they will make a power which cannot be confronted with any army or power. He analyzes the Iranian people's confrontation with the armed to the teeth royal army in this framework. Foucault explains why the Shah regime failed to resist against the people despite the high military and economic power. He says that although the Shah's army possessed the most advanced weapons and equipment in the region and enjoyed the consultation of over 40,000 American advisors, it was defeated by the people who sacrificed all they had in the way of their leader. As for the economic power too, the regime enjoyed exorbitant oil revenues which would fill the coffers of the royal family. Foucault maintains that the Iranian society was not that poor to cause the people to topple the ruling system. Of course, this is not true, and poverty can be considered one of the factors for the nationwide uprising of the Iranian people. Michel Foucault fails to understand the depth of the Iranian people's belief in and love of their religious leaders, especially the bravest and most uncompromising of them, Imam Khomeini. Moreover, he has not realized the fact that, except the top brass, the main fiber of the army was formed of popular forces and officers who defied the commands of their top commanders in shooting and killing their compatriots and Muslim brothers. French thinker Michel Foucault relates what he had seen in one of the suburbs of Tehran during the Islamic Revolution. In a very unsafe place around Tehran, my friends made the preparations for my visit with a few top officers who were among the opponents of the Shah's regime. They told me that the more violent the unrest becomes, the regime would be forced to resort to the military units that are neither ready for the job nor have they the motive for it. Moreover, they would understand that they are not facing the international communism, but the ordinary people, the businessmen, employees, or jobless people who are like their brothers or themselves. These people can be forced to shoot only once, but not the second time. 8 months ago, they were forced in Tabriz to change the garrisons. In Tehran too, although some units have come from other provinces, they were forced to change them. Foucault makes it clear that he has heard that some of the military forces had targeted their commanders or committed suicide the day after shooting the ordinary people. Michel Foucault continues on the Islamic Revolution. What astonished me in Iran is that there is no battle among different elements. What makes all these beautiful and important is that there is only a single confrontation. The confrontation of all people with the power which threatens the people with weapons and police. No need to go very far. This point can be understood instantly. On one side, there is the entire will of the people, and on the other side, there are the machine guns. Foucault compares the Islamic Revolution of Iran with other revolutions and says, Iran's events, in fact, are not found in China, or in Vietnam, or in Cuba. It is a huge wave without a military tool, without a party in the front. It is the first paradoxical phenomenon, and the reason for the hastiness of these events is that people have struggled for 10 months against a regime which is one of the most armed regimes in the world, and that with bare hands, without resorting to armed struggle. They have petrified the army bravely and decisively. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujjah, Ajalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you, as we gather to commemorate the Istishhad anniversary of our 6th Imam, Imam Ja'far As-Sadiq, Alayhima, Afdalus Salatu, Wassalam. Ma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that we each get an opportunity to go for the ziyarat of our Imam to Baqi, inshaAllah, and that we receive his shafaat in the hereafter. We are gathered to remember and benefit from the beautiful legacy of our sixth Imam alayhi salam, and as well lament at his untimely assassination by the Abbasid government. Our Imam alayhi salam, as we know, shares the birth date of our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. On the 17th of Rabiul Awal in the year 83 after Hijrah. And his imamate began in the year 114 after Hijrah. And it's lasted for a period of 34 years. These 34 years we've talked about previously, but I think these type of biodata information is really important, you know. That the 34 years of imamate were generally split in two. Half, or a little bit more than half, was under the governorship or the caliphate of the Umayyad, but it was during the fall of the Umayyad dynasty, where in a span of 17 years you had five different caliphs who came because, again, there was chaos. And then it coincided with the next 15 or 16 years of the Abbasid rule, which then took on many decades after that. And the Abbasid rule, the Imam alayhi salam had to deal with Al-Mansur al-Dawaniqi, who eventually poisoned the Imam alayhi salam. But this opportunity that the Imam presented is something that we've talked about in the past, is that it opened a door for him to leave a legacy and to have an imprint in society to that extent that, you know, we proudly have labeled ourselves as Ja'fari today. You know, it's from the ihsan of our sixth Imam who showed us that at a time, you know, when there were so many different groups and so many different ideologies, he showed us the path of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. And we are grateful for that. You know, we are grateful for that, and we owe him our adoration. And more so than that, we owe him our obedience, you know, in following the teachings that he has given us and that he has provided for us. And the legacy of the Imam, the treasure trove that the Imam alayhi salam has left us is wide. It's literally wide. You know, if you open of any book of hadith, the majority hadith that we have come from our fifth and our sixth Imams. You know, there is this, any hadith book, I have this really huge volume set called Kalima. Yeah, it has the words of Kalimatullah, Kalimatul Rasul. It's a really good book, yeah, but it's in Arabic. But it's 26 volumes, and four of these volumes, and each one is by for different Imam, but four volumes are of the sixth Imam. Just that's how much we have, and that's not even the extent of it, but that's the legacy that we have. And so what I like to do is I like to look at these traditions time to time to try to see, okay, the purpose and the goal of the Imam was to make my life better and to make my faith stronger and allow me to know what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects. And this is how the Imam alayhi salam grew adoration from the people. But this was also how the Abbasid caliphate began to detest the Imam, because they saw that the people were gravitating towards the Imam, and so they found that they had to find ways of sidelining them. And it is this Mansur al-Dawaniqi who viewed the Imam alayhi salam as a threat to his government. And history tells us that in numerous occasions he sent poison towards the Imam alayhi salam or tried to assassinate him. But it was in this final moment that on the 25th of Shawwal, the Imam ingested poisoned grapes and eventually his life came to an end. But you know, my brothers and sisters, there's one more event that happened prior to this. It is said Mansur sent a servant by the name of Muhammad bin Sulaiman. And he told him to go to Medina and burn down the house of the Imam. It is said this mal'oon came and he put dried wood around the house of the Imam. And then he set it ablaze. It is said the Imam alayhi salam came out. He brought his family out. They began to extinguish the fire and he would cry out, Ana ibn Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Ana ibn Ali al-Murtada. Ana ibn Fatima al-Zahra. He says, I am the grandson of Rasulullah. Why do you do this? He just said that after the fire was put out for days, when the companions would come to see the Imam, he would see the Imam crying. He says to the Imam, the companions would say that this is a physical gift, why do you cry? Another one may ask the Imam alayhi salam that this was not the first time your house has been set on fire. For these mal'uneen have set the house of Zahra on fire prior to that. The Imam alayhi salam says, look, I understand what you are saying to me, that this is a material existence, that this was not the first time. We have faced brutality for a long time. But he said that when this fire took over my house, I looked at the women and children of my house and how they were running from one location to another. And we were able to bring them to safety. But in that moment, I thought of my aunt Zainab in Karbala. That when they began to burn down the tents in Karbala, Zainab's hijab had been looted already. There were no males who were there to assist them except for Imam Sajjad, who was ill. It is at this time that Zainab would look at Sajjad and says, my son, what should we do? And they came out of these tents. This is the brutality of the Imam that he endured in his life. When the poison spread through his entire body, the Imam called his family and gave him his last will. And then the Imam faced the Qibla and he stretched his arms and his legs. Sweat beads began to appear on his forehead. The Imam took his last breath. Rahimallahu man nada wa imama. The Imam has left this world. The children of the Imam gathered and cried at the janazah of their father. فَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا وَيَّمٌ قَلَبِيًا قَلِبُونَ
كَيْفَ لَا يَرْقُونَ مِصْطَاحَ الْهُدَى وَهُوَ شَمْسٌ نُورُهَا طُولَ الْمَدَى صَادِقُ الْأَقْوَالِ
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters,
9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
In Britain, travelers faced the second day of disruption on Britain's railways on Saturday, 13th of May, as the union leader Mick Lynch insisted the 24-hour strike had not targeted the Eurovision Song Contest. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Passengers faced a second day of disruption on Britain's railways on Saturday as the union leader Mick Lynch insisted the 24-hour strike had not targeted the Eurovision Song Contest. Train crews are staging another 24-hour strike immediately after Friday's action by drivers, disrupting people travelling to Liverpool for the Eurovision final, as well as National League football fans heading to Wembley in North London. The RMT Union's General Secretary Mick Lynch said the timing of the latest action was because of anti-trade union laws rather than targeting specific dates. "We've not targeted Wembley or Liverpool or any of the activities that people get up to," he said in an interview with BBC. "There isn't a day where people aren't undertaking important activities in business life or personal life. We don't set the date for Eurovision. We don't set the anti-trade union laws that require us to have a mandate that expires after 6 months. Today is the last day under the anti-union laws that we can have a strike under the mandate. You get 6 months to run action. After that 6 months, you cannot take any more action. Today is the last Saturday of our previous mandate." Mick Lynch added, "We give 2 weeks' notice under the law, which is what the government requires us. But if we didn't take strike action today, we wouldn't have been able to take any more during that mandate. So that's down to the anti-trade union laws." Ministers again urge unions to put sub-inflation pay offers to their members, but the Labour Party said the government had guaranteed a weekend of chaos by refusing to hold talks with the unions. More trains will run than on Friday, 12th of May, but most networks will have a very limited service as RMT members at 14 train operating companies in England strike. A large number of smaller stations from the north to the southeast will close, while in many places trains will stop running by 7 p.m. Merseyrail, which is not affected by strikes, is running services, but intercity trains will terminate earlier. In Wales and Scotland, where unions are not in dispute, Only cross-border services will be affected. While Saturday was the last remaining date legally allowed under their existing mandate, RMT members have now voted to keep striking for another 6 months if necessary. Mick Whelan, the General Secretary of the ASLEF Union, said on Friday he had been unaware that Eurovision would be affected by strikes, but added, if somebody can name me a day where there's not an event that isn't going to get a hit at some point, if there's any form of disruption, I'd love to know. The Rail Minister, Hugh Merriman, again urged the RMT Union and ASLEF leadership to put the pay offers to a full vote, but unions have accused the government of hampering a deal. Mick Whelan said they had neither had hide nor hair from the government that are meant to be facilitating and aiding these talks since a meeting with Hugh Merriman on 6th of January. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, has not met unions this year. Lynch said earlier this week that the government had tied the hands of the railway companies and prevented them from offering a fair deal. The Rail Delivery Group, representing train operators, has said it was blindsided by the RMT union rejecting its last offer, which it claimed had been agreed by both sides in the negotiating room. The Shadow Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, said it was staggering that complacent ministers haven't held any talks to avert this disruptive strike action. The Conservatives' irresponsible approach is guaranteeing a weekend of chaos, and it's the public which will have to pay the price. Trains will also be disrupted over the next week, the industry has said, owing to an overtime ban brought in across 15 operating companies by ASLEF from 15 to 20th of May inclusive. Rail firms have said it could mean more cancellations and delays and could particularly affect passengers travelling in and out of London. Two further strikes are planned by train drivers on 31st of May and 3rd of June, the date of the FA Cup final. Press Association PA Media has also covered this story and tells us more. Rail passengers will suffer fresh travel chaos on Saturday, 13th of May, because of another strike amid an escalation of long-running disputes over pay. Members of the Rail Maritime and Transport Union, RMT Union, will walk out at 14 train operators across England on the day of the Eurovision Song Contest final in Liverpool. The strike follows action on Friday, 12th of May, by train drivers in the ASLEF Union, which crippled services with some parts of England having no trains all day. ASLEF's General Secretary Mick Whelan revealed there had been no meetings with the government since early January, despite continuing deadlock over the pay row. He told the Press Association news agency that drivers were prepared to continue taking industrial action until they had a decent pay offer. ASLEF has described an offer of an 8% wage rise over 2 years as risible. Mick Whelan, who joined picket lines in Manchester and Liverpool, said the government seems to think they can starve us back to work or that we will give up, but that isn't going to happen. We're in this for the long haul and there will be more strikes. ASLEF has called further stoppages on 31st of May and 3rd of June, the day of the FA Cup final at Wembley. The Rail Delivery Group, the RDG, said that after many weeks of negotiations with the ASLEF leadership, it had made a revised and fair offer, including a pay rise of 8% over 2 years. It would have introduced overdue common sense improvements already in place in parts of the network, which would see more trains running on time for passengers. Sadly, this has been rejected, said a spokesperson. Passengers were urged to check before they travel on Saturday, 13th of May. Israel is not affected by the industrial action and is expected to run a normal service during the Eurovision Song Contest. The RMT's General Secretary Mick Lynch said he expected solid support for Saturday's walkout. He said this strike takes place in the wake of a recent re-ballot of members working for 14 train operating companies, which massively reaffirmed a mandate for further industrial action. Throughout this dispute, the government has tied the hands of the railway companies and prevented them offering a fairer deal. We are striking so that the employers and government can see the huge anger amongst rail workers is very real, and they need to recognize that fact, face reality, and make improved proposals. We are calling for the rail companies to get around the table with RMT Union and negotiate in good faith for a better deal for rail workers. The RMT pointed out that when it re-balloted its members recently, there was a massive vote to continue taking strike action. Saturday, 13th of May, was chosen for a strike as it was the last date allowed under employment laws, said the RMT Union. There will be more train services on Saturday than on Friday, 12th of May, but many companies are restricting their number of routes and hours of operation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023. the late Mr. Taleghani told me the day when Imam Khomeini said the Shah must go, I thought, what is he talking about? Now, Mahmoud Taleghani was no ordinary person. In other words, someone like the late Ayatollah Taleghani, a profound fighter with all the great history that he had, was not optimistic about this. But it happened. The revolution was victorious. I shall surely prevail, I and my messengers. All the imposed war of Iraq upon Iran. You weren't around then. You didn't see it. The imposed war was a strange event. Everyone was against us. The US was against us. The Soviet Union was against us. NATO was against us. Muslim countries were against us. Our neighbor, Turkey, was against us. Everyone. But we were victorious. In such a war, where everyone was against us, we were victorious. Therefore, our experience shows us the same thing. This is what awaiting the reappearance of the Saviour is about. Awaiting the reappearance does not mean that we should just sit around waiting and praying that God will send Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajah sharif to us. Nevertheless, praying for his reappearance is something obligatory that we must do.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We need to pray. We must want this. We need to pursue it, but that's not enough. Awaiting the reappearance means that whenever there is a problem in the things we are doing, we need to believe that the time of the reappearance that we are awaiting will come. A person needs to have this expectation. Of course, there are certain necessary conditions. We need to make an effort. Awaiting the Saviour means that when you want to eat bread, you need to go to the bakery and buy the bread first. The bread is not going to come to you if you want to sit at home and wait for it. Action needs to be taken for the reappearance to occur. These are the principles that require work. There are many such principles. Or there is the principle of monotheism. A sovereign other than God is forbidden. Monotheism means the negation of the sovereignty of other than God. And there are numerous other similar examples. Your associations particularly need to work on these principles. And don't focus on a small, limited point. Widen your perspective. Look at all the issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.